The worst draft for me was Tennessee's draft because I'm on record. I just don't like Carnell Tate that high.
Way too high.
You know.
Like, do you see him as a number one in the NFL?
No, I'm not on. No, I don't see him being a number one.
I don't remember a receiver ever picked this high where I'd go, he was never even the number one receiver on his college team.
He hasn't been the number one on the team that he's been on. I mean, you have to be a number one on the team that you're coming from to be a number one receiver that the team that you're going to.
That is the crazy thing about it.
I don't think he's necessarily limited to being this, you know, high-end number two, can't be a number one. I think he could be a number one receiver in an offense.
It's one thing to be a first-round receiver. It's another thing to be the first receiver. Extra attention, extra pressure.
Yeah.
But I hope and I have faith that Carnell Tate, just from being around him, he's a Lego guy.
Yeah.
Just from being around him at the combine, I think he can pull it off.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Music City Audible, a Tennessee Titans podcast live edition midweek live show. I'm your host, Justin Graver, full-time NFL podcast producer for Odyssey. And joining me, as always, the managing editor of Titan Size, the publisher of NFL Draft on SI, and the people want me to say it, so I'll say it. I don't want to say it every day, but I guess I'm saying it today. The yada yada king, my co-host, Justin Mello. Justin, how you doing today? We're going to cover this big debate, I guess, question that was a huge topic on draft Twitter. Can Carnell Tate be a number one wide receiver in the NFL? But we also have some other Titans-related news and stuff to hit. Dave Ziegler spoke at a press conference yesterday. We'll touch on that stuff first. Justin, how you doing?
I'm doing well, doing well. Yeah, a lot to talk about. We cooked up this topic and decided to stick with it. Dave Ziegler spoke, like you mentioned, and we got the bombshell in the evening out of nowhere that Titans president Chad Brinker has decided to step down effective immediately. I guess, you know, it's probably on his mind for a while, waiting for after the NFL draft to officially do it. Lots to talk on that topic as well. I've got probably more thoughts than you do. But yeah. Definitely one that I think shook the at least the local landscape. Definitely, you know, they didn't see it coming and dominating headlines this morning.
Yeah, so let's start there. Chad Brinker steps down. We don't really know why or what caused this or where this came from. The Titans posted this statement from Brinker on social media last night. Talk about a late night news dump. That's what this was yesterday. Chad wrote, "It has been an honor to serve as president of football operations of the Tennessee Titans. Over the years, I've understood and embraced my role as a leader of blah, 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 blah. I've spent less time in personnel. As I've spent less time in personnel, I have a renewed conviction that it is time to return to what I love and move towards my next chapter. I'm grateful for Amy's understanding my decision, blah, blah, blah. I'm proud of the work we've done, blah, 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 a bunch of blah, blah, blah." I think that's the crux of it right there, right at the top. As I've spent less time in personnel, I have a renewed conviction that it is time to return to what I love. So, if you all will remember, Chad Brinker hires Mike Borgonzi as general manager. And then right at the beginning of this year in January, they restructure the front office again. So, when Borgonzi was hired, Brinker was above Borgonzi as sort of president of football operations. And then here's our GM, and we had this long, you know, debate about like, well, who's really in charge? Is Brinker in control? Does Borgonzi, does he actually get to do the job of a GM? Blah, blah, blah. In January, they were like, okay, we're going back to being a normal NFL front office structure. We're going to put Brinker as the president. We're going to put Borgonzi as the general manager. Borgonzi has full roster control. Brinker is handling the other things that are like data analytics, salary cap management, that kind of boring stuff, I guess, in Brinker's mind, if you take this statement at its word. 4 months later, Brinker resigns. So I would guess that it has to do with Brinker not being as involved in the personnel side, and that's what he really wants to do. And maybe he didn't agree with the team taking Carnell Tate over Arvell Reese and Sonny Styles. Maybe he did. We don't know. We have heard that there was a consensus on the pick. So I don't know if he's part of that consensus anymore because he's not on the personnel side. Here's what I'll say, and then I'll turn it over to you, Justin. Brinker receded into the shadows back in January. He's handling things that have nothing to do with the actual roster now. I don't give a crap about this news. I really don't care. I'm like, okay, cool. Brinker's gone. Day-to-day the team operation doesn't really change much. Does somebody need to go do his job now? Yes. And hopefully that somebody's not Mike Borgonzi, because I don't want more put on his plate. I want him to handle what he's been handling, because I think he crushed free agency and the draft. But I beyond that, like, I really couldn't care less about this news. Like, okay, bye, Chad Brinker. Like, if you don't want to be here, don't be here. See ya. See ya later. Sayonara. Bye-bye.
I do think what's obviously interesting here is national, you know, analysts, national insiders, whatever you want to call them, a lot of them have already kind of, you know, jumped to conclusions, if you will, and defaulted to the norm, which is more instability in the Tennessee Titans front office, right? Like, just, and I, on the outside looking in, if you don't know better, you look at everything that's happened there. You go back to, like, Rand Carthon, you know, John Robinson's fired, Mike Vrabel, Rand Carthon's hired, Mike Vrabel's fired. Chad Brinker's hired after Rand Carthon, eventually goes above Rand Carthon. Rand Carthon's fired. He oversees the process of hiring the new GM. He hires Mike Borgonzi. He's above Mike Borgonzi. Then they elevate Borgonzi to above him, and now he's stepping down. I don't think this is that. I don't think this is an instability thing. I'm taking this statement at face value. I do think, you know, we know that Mike Borgonzi's in charge. We know he hired Robert Saleh. He's making the draft picks. He's signing the free agents. We know Chad Brinker's doing the quote-unquote boring business-related side of the football stuff, right? Like, it's still a company. It's still a business, and things need to be done, and that's what they were empowering Chad Brinker to do. Well, he's a football guy. He doesn't want to be an accountant. He doesn't want to be a CEO, whatever you want to call it. He wants to do football things. I want to do hood rat things with my friends. Chad Brinker wants to do football things with his friends. Wasn't allowed to do football things here anymore. And he steps down. I don't think this is instability. I don't think it's any of that. And I wager, and I also, maybe it's a hot take. I think Chad Brinker is overly hated in this fan base. And you've said that before. The way I look at it, he came in after Rand Carthon, right? He's initially below Rand Carthon, assistant GM. You can't convince me that Rand Carthon and Chad Brinker were in lockstep on how to run the team. I think when Chad Brinker first rose above Rand Carthon, and I wish you could have an honest conversation with him, he'd probably say, like he was new to that role being above him. He's still the GM. I'm going to let him do his thing. I bet you, again, honest conversation with Chad Brinker, that he wishes he meddled more early. Because I don't think what Rand Carthon did in free agency, the Calvin Ridleys, the L'Jarius Sneed trade, Lloyd Cushenberry, I don't think that stuff aligns with how Chad Brinker believes how you should build a football team. He comes from the Green Bay Packer way, draft and develop. I think he was a little too hands-off and regrets it. Do I have proof? No. Do I think there's a really good example that backs my statement? Yes. When he goes out and hires Mike Borgonzi, I think Mike Borgonzi, the way he wants to build a football team, draft and develop and all that, I think that aligns with how Chad Brinker believes in building a football team. There is no more anti-Rand Carthon than Mike Borgonzi. And when Chad Brinker had an opportunity to hire his own general manager, he went in the total opposite direction of Rand Carthon with Mike Borgonzi. So that's why I think he's a little overhated for some of the Rand Carthon stuff. Maybe he deserves a lot of hate for Brian Callahan, I'll say that, because it does sound like he was fairly involved in the head coaching hiring process alongside Rand Carthon. But all that to say, I'm not concerned about this at all. I don't think this is the typical Amy Adams drunk, unstable organization. I think a lot of national pundits are defaulting to that because that's all they know. I don't get that impression here. And Paul Kuharski's already got a replacement in mind. He talks about Bryce Wasserman, who's got a really interesting background and is now Amy Adams' strong son-in-law. So yeah. Wouldn't shock me if he kind of takes up these day-to-day duties and responsibilities.
Yeah, I think Brinker did a lot of good things, by the way. Like, he basically built the analytics department. He turned it from a one-person job or one- or two-person job into, like, a multi-departmental like thing, like the analytics side of the evaluation from, you know, recruiting and, or not recruiting, but scouting and evaluating players both in college and in the league, to like managing player performance and practice and, you know, weight, load bearing management, all that stuff. Like, he incorporated a lot of good things into the front office that I hope they keep and continue to do. But if he's not involved in the personnel side and he's just like kind of a glorified cap manager, then I think this team's going to function just fine without him. I totally agree with you about the dysfunction angle. Like, I don't think this is an indicator of any further dysfunction. I don't think Mike Borgonzi won some kind of power struggle with Brinker.
He had
Yeah, I think this is just Brinker being like, you know what, this job isn't what I wanted to do. And I've made a lot of money and I can afford to step away for a few months. And I don't think I'll be on the market long. And, you know, the franchise I came from, the assistant general manager just got hired to be the GM of the Dolphins. So maybe there's room for me back home. I think he probably winds up back in Green Bay, if not somewhere else.
Or Miami.
And beyond that.
Or Miami
with his friends there. Yeah. And beyond that, like, I really don't care that much about Chad.
The Vikings have a GM opening. Maybe he interviews that still. I think maybe he interviews there. And remember, like, Borgonzi doesn't have, you're talking about Brinker not having as much or any say in personnel. Even when Mike Borgonzi is going through this process, I get the impression he leans on Dave Ziegler, who does the press conference yesterday, Dan Sagany, John Salge, who were doing the, they did some stuff recently with the official Titans podcast that's on YouTube, talking about the class. Now, granted, they probably knew Brinker was stepping down. Maybe that's why they don't put him on stuff like that. But I think there's lots of people in this front office that sort of have the ear of Chad Brinker. Sorry, that have the ear of Mike Borgonzi when it comes to personnel.
There. I agree with that. I didn't want to spend this much time on this topic, but I have to say
Let's move on. You bring in your final point. We'll shout out Gary Soto, and then we'll move on.
Borgonzi said this back in January, I think, when the initial restructuring was done. Borgonzi said, "Chad is invaluable to me. Chad hired me, Amy hired me to really construct the roster. That's what they hired me for. That's what they empowered me to do. What Chad does is he has knowledge in scouting. He's got knowledge in the salary cap strategy. Chad is really smart." That's how he says it. That's how Borgonzi talks. He's really smart. He doesn't say smart, you know, because of the Boston accent. Okay. And Chad supports me with all the decisions that I make, and it's no different in every other organization. You can say the titles and who's above who. It's the same structure in every organization. You got the GM, you got your VP of strategy, cap, and then you got the head coach. Whatever title you want to give them, those are the three people that work together to make decisions. So he did say Chad is invaluable to me, and he's very smart. He's got all this background stuff. But I do think you're right that he's leaning on all those other assistant GMs and former GMs probably a little bit more. Yeah, we can move on. Before we move on, we would like to shout out a couple of our super chats. Oh my goodness gracious. You like how I took the volume down? Some people were annoyed. Some people love the drop. Some people don't love the drop. They don't love how it interrupts.
I don't even know if I heard it. Is it, how low is it?
Was it too low?
Oh
my goodness gracious.
There.
I'll hit it again for the sake of that. Look, we're not interrupting the flow of our conversation here, right? We're going to transition topics anyway, so might as well use this opportunity to shout out Gary Soto, $50 super chat. Thank you so much for your support, Gary, who asks, "Did you see The Athletic has the Tennessee Titans ranked last in their post-draft power rankings? What's your take on that?" Once again, you don't have to answer now. Thank you, Gary. I did see that. I kind of just chuckled and laughed. I was like, you know, there's another article out. I can't remember where I read this. Actually, it might have even been The Athletic. No, I don't think it was The Athletic. There's another article out. It's like the five teams that are most improved. Oh, it was Matt Vederame of Sports Illustrated, your potential colleague-ish. Anyway, five most improved teams after the draft. He had the Titans included in that list. I would put the Titans on that side of the spectrum when it comes to like most improved versus worst team in the NFL. I would lean towards the most improved side. I don't know if they're the most improved, but I just laugh. I mean, post-draft power rankings are a clicks vehicle. They don't mean a whole lot. I did think it was funny that it's like, if the Dallas Cowboys had had the exact same 2025 season and off-season of 2026 that the Titans had, they'd be like 10th in the power rankings because they're the Cowboys. Because it's the Titans, they're like their 30 set we're totally forgotten about. But to me, it's like, whatever, who cares?
What gave me so much comfort in how stupid that list is, number one, I think there are a couple teams worse than the Titans. I get putting them low, you know, back-to-back three-win seasons. I'd probably put, like, the Cardinals, the Jets, like, those two teams strike me immediately. And the Miami Dolphins, who are telling you that they are tearing this thing down to the absolute studs of a rebuild, are like 23rd or 24th on that list. They're not even bottom five, okay? They had the Washington Commanders, who were in the NFC Championship game 2 years ago and lost Jaden Daniels to an injury. They had the Dolphins ahead of the Commanders. I'm like, that is border. That might be one. That's probably the worst thing on the power rankings list. Not even forget the Titans. The Commanders being like 26th and the Dolphins being ahead of them. What a terrible, terribly stupid list.
Yeah, so I don't spend a lot of time worrying about those kinds of lists. We got another one, super chat here from Dorian. Thank you very much, Dorian, for the tip. This is my first ever super chat. I finally catch y'all live. You guys should do a floor and ceiling prediction soon. I assume you're talking about for the Titans and their record. We'll probably do something like that after the schedule is announced. And Justin, I wasn't planning on doing this right now, but why not? Might as well. We do have a minor, small announcement to make here that I don't think you guys are going to be particularly happy about. So we've talked a lot about this. I think most people who watch the show know that I'm getting married a week from Saturday, May 9th. And there's a lot of activity surrounding the wedding. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a little break. It's May. Nobody cares about anything in May, right? We're not missing anything massive. We got rookie mini camps this weekend. We will talk about that stuff on Friday and on Monday. On Tuesday of next week, Justin and I are going to do a show, and that's going to be our last show until May 18th. So we will be off from Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and the following week, just going to take a little dark period. We haven't had a break from this show, Justin and I, since we started going live every single day last like July, I think. And even before that, we were still doing two episodes a week every week. So we're just going to take some time to regroup, to refresh ourselves. And we will be daily up to next Tuesday, including next Tuesday. We'll miss 8 weekdays from there. Just a little dark period for the show. And we'll be back on Monday, May 18th. So you guys will probably miss us during the time that we're gone. But thank you, Jordan here, who says, take a break, enjoy the wedding, let Gary take the reins.
This one killed me too. I lost it, damn it. Can Gary produce the pod? Can let Gary upload a pod? There's all kinds of Gary producing the pod is absolutely killing me. And then how about the Jessica's ruining my life from Bob over there? Even remembers the fiance name and says she's ruining his life. I love that.
Appreciate you guys. All right, we're going to move on now and talk about Dave Ziegler's press conference, because I like how the Titans do this. You know, they like let these other guys get some face time. I believe they did the same thing last year. Dave Ziegler yesterday came out, answered questions about the Titans draft process, about the offseason. And there was just a couple of things that stood out to me, Justin, not a ton that I wanted to cover from this. The first thing, though, is something we talked about yesterday. We did our depth chart projection yesterday. Talked about how we wouldn't be surprised if the Titans continued adding at the offensive line. You mentioned that Kevin Zeitler should be listed at the top of the right guard depth chart. We both mentioned that we wouldn't be surprised if they brought in some swing tackle help. Well, here is Dave Ziegler answering a question yesterday about the state of the offensive line right now, letting guys compete in the, who's going to compete to potentially start, and the idea of possibly still adding players at this position.
We're going to give those guys an opportunity. They have the opportunity this spring to prove themselves and to, earn the trust of the offensive staff and you know, have an opportunity to secure a role. But we're also going to look to bring competition in. And if we can improve a position, we'll improve it.
So I thought it was interesting the way he framed that. It's like, we're going to use this spring to see if we got anything in these guys. And if we get through the spring and we're like, shoot, we don't have anything with these guys, then we'll go see what's still available on the market. But first and foremost, the guys in-house will have a chance to compete and prove themselves and show that they can be our starters on the offensive line. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, Ray School just made a comment that I was about to make. Like, Easton Freeze kind of keeps doubling down that it doesn't really look like there's much between the Titans and Kevin Zeitler right now, and that he doesn't believe that Kevin Zeitler will be returning. Paul Kuharsky brought up a good point on a story yesterday too. Like, under this CBA agreement, you get such few, compared to older days, if you will, you get such few padded practices and everything that there's not really that much assessment time to make these big decisions, right? And you're going to have preseason games and joint practices. Like, you're going to have some opportunities, but really big decisions to make with, you know, is Cordell Volson, like Dave Ziegler said, we like Cordell Volson. We like his size, his experience. Like, is he going to be your week one starter at right guard? Do you have enough time to assess that he's back and capable of doing that? Like, there are just so many questions on this O-line right now that make me very uneasy, in all honesty, regarding how little time, like Iron Grant, 16 padded practices, something along those lines. Not a whole lot. You add 3 preseason games to that. That obviously doesn't include joint practices. They're going to have a couple of those. So if you include preseason, you're going to have about 20 opportunities, you know, 20 days, 20 opportunities to make that assessment, to make those decisions. Better get it right. You know, Cam Ward's health might depend on it.
Yeah. He also talked about Jackson Slater and talked about, you know, how they're excited to see his development, talked about some other guys in the room too. So we'll see how it shakes out. Like, I'm not pressing the panic button yet. I would be lying if I said it wasn't a concern. It's like, I mean, if we were doing a pod about the top concerns that could derail the Titans 2026 season, interior offensive line is my number one concern and swing tackle is my number two concern. So the fact that my top two concerns are offensive line related, not great. But,
you sound concerned then.
But we'll see what happens, because I think, you know, they do have time to sort this out. There are still players out there that could help this team. And who knows what they have in Jackson Slater? Who knows if, I mean, Austin Schlotman in 4 games last year as a starter played pretty well. And so did Corey Levin. And if they can get Corey Levin level play from Schlotman, then that would be serviceable on the offensive line. If Slater can be a starting right guard in the NFL, even just an average level, that's a win for a 5th-round draft pick. I would be excited to see those guys get a shot to play. And then they got 2 rookies in there who have played a lot of football, who bring a lot of toughness and football intelligence. That was another thing Ziegler talked about, was all the Zooms that the offensive line coach and the offensive staff did with these offensive linemen that they ended up drafting. And talking about how, like, we did a lot of Zooms, multiple Zooms with some of these guys, because we think the football intelligence piece is so critical. And if they hit on these picks, then they will be fine. If they miss on these picks, then they have some concerns. So it's all sort of TBD for me right now.
I'm going to give credit to our buddy Mike Herndon, even though I don't know if he has said this publicly, but I know he said it in a group chat that we're in. I guess if you are concerned, then you maybe should be. It reminds me of, like, was it Brian Callahan's first season, I think, where it's like, well, we've got guys, we're going to let them compete. We've got NPF and we've got Dylan Radins. And we've got Sadiq Charles. Like, they had all these guys in that room. Yeah. They're like, we believe in their young talent. We're going to let them compete. And we believe in what we've got. I mean, it's always easy in the offseason to be like, I think all football fans tend to see a best case scenario, right? It's like, well, these guys, they're my favorite team. This is going to work out, obviously. I can't wait for the season. I love this. Then the season comes and you're week 2 in and you're like, oh my God, they cannot block anyone. Right? Oh my God, the right guard situation is really bad, or the center situation is really bad. Like, I think that's the realistic concern. Like, that's the worst case scenario. And it's realistic based on the lack of, you know, proven talent that they have in the room right now. That's my fear, is we get here and we're like, I can't believe how stupid we were for thinking that this might work out based on the lack of talent in this room. That's the worry.
Yeah, I think that's a fair worry. And definitely having that history in mind hurts you. It does make you question, like, what was the strategy? You want to hit this really quick? Jordan asks, which of our players we just signed do you think will retire a week before training camp? My favorite Titans tradition. That would
be
funny.
We're on a run, right? Sadiq Charles 2 years ago, Lorenzo Carter last year.
I would guess the favorite's got to be somebody who already retired and then came back, and that's Lance McCutcheon, the bottom of the depth chart receiver. And if that happens,
then say that.
Nobody really cares if he retires, right?
But I did want to play a strong candidate, Malik Herring, maybe, like the DN.
I was thinking Malik Herring too.
I don't know.
I wanted to play another answer from Ziegler here because I thought this was interesting. Basically, talking about the approach to the offensive line. The question wasn't, why didn't you do more in free agency at this position? But Ziegler kind of touches on it. This is 2 separate responses to 2 separate questions excerpted from 2 answers popped together in 1 clip. And I will tell you why I find this so intriguing, because it also aligns with some stuff that we heard earlier this offseason.
In terms of, hey, like, you got to be fluid in this business with plans, you know? And so, you know, free agency, when you go into free agency, obviously it's People have different options and there's money involved and, you know, things of that nature. So, you know, the chips fall where they fall, and you got to make the decisions that you make to bring the players in. There's, you know, a lot of different moving parts in free agency because you're talking about cash and money, and, you know, we signed a lot of players. The deals, we were able to get some deals done with receivers and we got those deals done. There was other deals that, you know, we were looking into, and other players that we were looking into that just kind of didn't fall our way, or people made other decisions. And so you kind of, you know, you regroup and you stay fluid and you got to move on.
So to me, what's really interesting about that is that we did have a report. I think it was like the second or third week of free agency. Paul Kaharsky reported that the center market surprised the Titans, caught them off guard a little bit, that they thought that they were going to be able to be in on Tyler Linderbaum, that who's the Buffalo guy, Connor McGovern, who was like supposed to hit free agency, ends up not hitting free agency, and those two guys were supposedly at the top of the Titans center wish list. And Luke Fortner was also reported as a possibility. Obviously, McGovern goes back to Buffalo before free agency opens. Linderbaum gets a record-setting contract with the Raiders, so Titans were never going to go up that high. And they didn't end up landing the other guy I just mentioned, whose name now just escaped my brain.
Luke Fortner, who signed a pretty cheap deal in free agency, so that's one that's interesting. I think he got like $6 million a year, I think.
Right, and where did he sign? In
Carolina.
Carolina, yeah. So, I don't know. I think it's interesting that he's basically saying, yeah, we had a plan to sign some free agent offensive linemen, maybe, and the guys that we were targeting either didn't become available or decided to sign elsewhere. Now, he didn't say that verbatim, explicitly, but that's basically what he was telling us there. I just thought that's interesting that they did have a plan. They did want to address these spots with some free agents, and they weren't able to, for whatever reason, get those deals done. It tells you a little bit about their strategy, and you just have to be fluid and adapt when that doesn't come to fruition. It didn't come to fruition for them, so it kind of is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it is what it is now, but we'll be mad about it if they suck, and that's a big reason why they suck. And I hope it's not a talking point that we're constantly revisiting during the season. They've got some work to do here. Austin Slotman, Pat Coogan, Fernando Carmona, Jackson Slater, Cordell Volson. Five candidates to start at right guard and center. None of them should inspire a ton of confidence, so they've got to sort through what they've got there. And then Kevin Zeitler, Greg Van Rotten, who I think is still available, who obviously knows Brian Daboll and Carmen Brasillo really well. And anyone else out there, there are a couple other interior linemen, so curious to see how this plays out and what the payoff ends up being when September actually gets here.
So Liegman has an interesting comment here. Let's face it. All we need is Zeitler to re-sign and we will probably feel 10 times better.
I would.
I agree with this. And this is where when I was saying I'm a little concerned, but I'm not hitting the panic button yet, is that this is true because you feel great about the right guard spot if Zeitler re-signs. Mm-hmm. If Jackson Slater shows up to mandatory mini camps in the first week of June or whenever those are, and looks like he took a huge step in his development and ready for the big times and to be the starting right guard, then your right guard position feels solidified and you feel a lot better about it. So that's basically what Dave Ziegler said. We're going to give these guys a chance to come in and prove it and improve themselves. And that's what they're doing. So if Jackson Slater does show up as a starting caliber right guard, then everything's fine. And that's why I'm not hitting the panic button yet. So we'll see. It's sort of the same thing. Re-signing Zeitler or Slater turns out to be capable, then you're good at that spot. And all you're really worried about is the center competition. And you hope that you can get away with a guy being a little below league average if you have to. Or you hope that Schlotman is league average or that Pat Coogan is good enough to start right away. So that's how I feel about it. Justin, was there anything else that Dave Ziegler said that stood out to you? I'm going to play his answer on Carnell Tate in a second, and we're going to shift our conversation to that. But before we do, I wanted to see if you had any other takeaways from the presser.
No, we're 29 minutes in, and we haven't talked about the episode topic. So I think
so
we're going to...
let's take a break here for the audio audience. And on the other side of the break, I will play this Carnell Tate quote, a Dave Ziegler quote on Carnell Tate. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We talk about mental health more openly now, but asking for help can still feel hard, and BetterHelp's latest research confirms it.
BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma report surveyed 2,000 Americans and revealed that 85% of Americans believe getting support is wise, yet 74% say society discourages people from actually doing so. What can we as a society do to close this gap between believing in mental health support and actually seeking it out?
Well, we can start by encouraging each other to seek support when we need it. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, you should know that BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform.
All you have to do to get started is fill out a short questionnaire, and BetterHelp takes care of matching you with a therapist. The best part? If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from any of BetterHelp's tailored recommendations.
Don't let stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
He's a receiver that can win at all three levels of the defense. You see him stretch the field. I think the unique thing about Carnell, too, is for a guy that's 6'2", he's a guy that can separate in a short area. He can run the majority of the route tree. And so what that means is you get a player that can also be productive on third down. But then you have this catch radius and the size and big hands where you see him show up in the red zone. And so that's what I think is unique about Carnell, is that a lot of times you get the bigger, taller, linear receivers. They're more like, I call them first and second down guys. You know, they're not productive on third down because they don't have the route tree to do that. Or you have a bigger guy that doesn't consistently play big at the catch point. Carnell checked a lot of those boxes in that way, where we're feeling we're really getting a complete three down player that can contribute on these critical downs and these critical situations, third down in the red zone. And so for us, having that vision, seeing that consensus, he was a clear guy for us to take, and we were excited about it.
Is Carnell Tate a wide receiver one in the NFL? At the top of the show, I played a montage of clips, some analysts critiquing Tate, some current NFL players, Malik Nabers, critiquing Carnell Tate. Can he be a wide receiver one? Some people say, nah, he's a high-end wide receiver two, safe, high-floor player, but he's got a low ceiling, never going to be a wide receiver one. Then I played that other clip, Sam Monson saying, I think he can be a wide receiver one. We got Hayden Winks, who I didn't play, said it on the show NFL Draft with Josh and Hayden when they broke down Carnell Tate. Hayden Winks comes out and says, I think he can be a wide receiver one. Mike Florio saying, I think he can get it done because I met him at the combine and he likes Legos. So I like him, so I think he can be a wide receiver one. Justin, we're going to have this debate today, and I want to start this debate by playing a fun little game with you, where we throw up a board that has, I'll just throw it up. This board has the Ohio State wide receivers who've been drafted in the first three rounds since 2018. So that's the left side, right? Just year from most recent to least recent, I guess. The wide receiver who was drafted, what pick number they were. And then in sort of this separate table off to the right, I have from most to least, most to fewest, their receiving yards per game in their final college season at Ohio State. One small caveat, Jaxon Smith-Njigba only played three games. His final season was pretty much dealing with like a hamstring injury the whole year. Sat out the bowl game to prepare for the draft. So I didn't use his final season because his final season was not really a real season. I used his second to last season. But everybody else, it's their final season on the right. This is not aligned, right? So Carnell Tate did not have the most yards. Emeka Ebuka did not have the second most yards. It's just aligned. It's just a, yeah, I scrambled them. I ranked them from most yards to fewest yards. And on the left is the players. And what I want to see if you can do, Justin, I want our live chat audience to play along here, is sort of like a pin the tail on the donkey. Can you tell me, and does it matter? We'll find out if it matters. Which player put up the yards per game, receiving yards per game in their final college season, like which player put up which number of yards per game. And then we'll talk through, like, can Carnell Tate be a wide receiver one? The main critique against him being a wide receiver one is that he was never the number one wide receiver on his own team. A lot of the guys on this list were never the wide receiver one on their own team. Some of them were sort of like a 1A, 1B, like Olave and Garrett Wilson came out at the same time. Egbuka, Harrison Jr., Jaxon Smith-Njigba, Chris Olave, and Garrett Wilson were all on the Ohio State team at the same time at one point. So they were all sort of playing second fiddle to each other at different points of their careers at Ohio State. With Jeremiah Smith there, who is going to be a top five, maybe top two pick next draft, depending on how many of these quarterbacks end up being great in the final pecking order at the top of the draft, like, nobody in college football is going to be the number one wide receiver at Ohio State with Jeremiah Smith across from them. It's just not the way he's just that good of a prospect. So it's a tough critique to say that, oh, because Cardinal Tate wasn't the wide receiver one, he can never be a wide receiver one in the NFL, when we've seen Justin Jefferson be the number two to Ja'Marr Chase and become one of, if not the best wide receiver in the NFL. A lot of guys on this list, Jaxon Smith-Njigba, maybe had like a season where he was the wide receiver one, but also not really because Marvin Harrison Jr. was there. So Justin, can you guess where, like, you start wherever you want to start, which one of these guys corresponds to which yardage on the right side of the screen? Let's see how well you do.
I'm going to start with Cardinal Tate because, yeah, he's the topic of discussion here.
Yeah.
I think that, okay, so I know that he missed a couple of games, and I know that he had what, like 850, 900 receiving yards last year, give or take. So that tells me he's not the first guy. He's not the second guy. I don't even think he's the third. He's not 96.2. I think he's below that. So he's either the 78 or the 79.5.
And?
Do you want me to keep going then? Is that what you're saying?
Okay. Which one do you got? Which one are you going with?
Oh, you want me to pick one or the other? Okay. 79.5.
Correct. Cardinal Tate averaged 79.5 yards per game in his final season at Ohio State, which, as you can see, is dead middle of these seven receivers. I want to know if you can do the other ones, because I just think it's interesting to see, like, based on where they were in their final college season and what we know of what they've become in the NFL, does this number matter that much? We always say production matters, and it does. But when you're in a specific offense, you know, some of these guys had C.J. Stroud throwing them the ball. Some of these guys had Will Howard throwing them the ball. Some of these guys had Julian Sayin last season, Cardinal Tate throwing them the ball. And I think we can all safely say that the best quarterback of that group is C.J. Stroud, despite whatever playoff struggles he's had recently. I actually think he had a better season overall last year than most people give him credit for. And he was great his rookie year, objectively great. Do you want to go down the list? Which one of these stat lines do you think belongs to Emeka Ebuka?
Ooh.
Tough one, huh?
I'm going to go with the 96.2.
That would be incorrect.
Okay.
You want to take another stab, or do you want me to tell you which one is his number? I mean, eventually it's going to be like process of elimination by the end, but so I don't want to give away too much.
I mean, it doesn't matter. I think Marvin Harrison Jr., is he number one, 123.5?
Nope.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's not what you think, huh? For all these
guys. Not necessarily.
Really.
I would have guessed Marvin Harrison was number... The JSN, you almost should have disqualified him because three games is so...
Yeah, so I used his second to last season when he played
season. Oh, okay, so you did disqualify his final year. Okay.
Yeah.
JSN, yeah, I don't know.
All right, I'll give the answers here if everybody in the chat wants to be done guessing. We got a correct guess from Ray Skull. Marvin Harrison Jr. was 100.9... yards per game, number two on this list. We got a guess from Theory that Garrett Wilson was number one with the 123 yards per game. No, Garrett Wilson was the 96.2 yards per game. That 123.5 yards per game belongs to who many people believe became the number one wide receiver in the NFL this past season. That was Jaxon Smith-Njigba's final year. Remember, he had a 200-plus yard game in the middle of the season, and then he had like 300-and-something yards in the bowl game that year, which was absolutely ludicrous. Chris Olave, 78 yards per game in his final season, right there next to Cardinal Tate's number. Emeka Ebuka, 63.2 yards per game in his final season. And Terry McLaurin, perhaps the reason that Terry McLaurin, you see the pick number of these guys, Cardinal Tate, fourth overall.
I had a feeling that one aligns just because of where he got drafted.
Yeah, Ebuka, 19th overall, Harrison, fourth overall, JSN, 20th overall, Olave and Garrett Wilson were picked back-to-back. Olave picked 11th overall, Garrett Wilson, one pick before him, 10th overall in the same draft. And then Terry McLaurin falls to the third round, 76 overall, perhaps because he only put up 50.1 receiving yards per game in his final season. So this doesn't really mean anything. I just thought it'd be interesting to look at the fact that JSN was more productive, or sorry, the JSN, that Carnell Tate was more productive than three of these guys who have gone on to become what I would call wide receiver ones, or at least borderline wide receiver ones in the NFL, in Chris Olave, Emeka Ibuka, who hasn't had a chance really to become a wide receiver one yet, and Terry McLaurin. I would say Terry McLaurin is a low-end wide receiver one in the NFL. I would say Chris Olave, if he could stay healthy and didn't have the major concussion problems that he's had, would be looked at as a lot better
he's wide receiver. He's a mid-tier wide receiver one, in my opinion, when he's healthy.
I fully agree. And I think that, you know, if Carnell Tate ends up at about that level, at the Terry McLaurin to Chris Olave level, I would say Garrett Wilson's in the same mix there too. Garrett Wilson has suffered from such pathetic quarterback play for every year except for one in his career. It's hard to even say.
I think
Wilson's a bit
better than those guys, though, to be honest, in my opinion. I think Garrett Wilson's a bit better than McLaurin. He's very consistent. He's healthy. He's always open. I put Wilson above, slightly above Olave, and borderline comfortably above McLaurin, in my opinion, as a player.
And, you know, even the disappointment that Marvin Harrison Jr. has been in the NFL. I mean, he put up 885 yards in 17 games as a rookie with 8 touchdowns. Last year, he only played 12 games, but was just about the same yards per game there, finished the year with 600 yards and 4 touchdowns. Like, even that guy has been disappointing. I think he's more been disappointing because he was looked at as such a generational prospect compared to his father, picked 4th overall, the highest of anybody on this list aside from Carnell Tate. But so my question then is, if Carnell Tate ends up in that range of guy, of receiver, is it a disappointment if you took him 4th overall? Do you need him to be Ja'Marr Chase level if you take him 4th overall? Or if he settles in as like a Chris Olave mid to lower tier wide receiver one, but still a wide receiver one, are you okay with that? Are you happy with that? How do you feel about that?
Yes, I would be okay with that personally. If he's a Chris Olave, Garrett Wilson, I think Emeka Ibuka's going to be amazing, by the way. I thought he looked so good this past year. Now that, you know, Mike Evans is out of the way there, I think Ibuka probably explodes this coming season. If he's in that tier of receiver, I'm happy. You know what's unfortunate is, I'm sure if that's where he settles, a lot of idiots are going to look back and say, hey, oh, you know, they reached for him, he's not as good, blah, blah, blah. Everyone's going to forget the context of this draft class, how weak this draft class appears at the top, right? Would you not take Chris Olave over a good linebacker? Would you not take Chris Olave over a good safety? Absolutely, I would. And that's what the Titans probably did here with Carnell Tate. But you're right, everyone's going to say, well, he's not Ja'Marr Chase. Well, Ja'Marr Chase wasn't an option. You know who was? Linebackers and safeties. That's who the options were at number 4. Yeah. So I think in that context of the class, I have no problem with Carnell Tate being like a Garrett Wilson, Chris Olave level wide receiver one.
I think he can be a wide receiver one for many of the reasons that Dave Ziegler ran through there. You know, it's that he's got the size and he's also got the route running ability to be that go-to guy on third down where you need 8 yards, he'll get you 9.
Right.
That kind of player. He's also going to be a threat in the red zone because, again, he's got size. He's got incredible hands and acrobatic catch ability that make him a target. You know, him saying, I'm always open, isn't necessarily like I'm always creating separation against a defensive back. Now, most of the time, he is creating a good amount of separation. But even when he doesn't, he's open. Because his 86% contested catch rate this past season shows you that even if he's covered, he can go up and make a play on the ball. And that's sort of what I think I'm always open means. It's like I'm always an available target to you. If you can put it in a spot where I can get my hands on it, I'm catching the ball. And that, to me, is the number one most important trait of a wide receiver. You know, John Robinson used to say, put it in a very simplified way that was kind of silly, but ultimately also true. We're looking for guys that can get open and catch the ball. Carnell Tate does those two things better than anybody in this draft class. And I think entering the NFL, he does it already at an elite rate. Now, obviously, he's got to prove that he can do it against NFL competition as part of an NFL offense when he doesn't have a generational wide receiver on the other side of the field. But let's not pretend that this is the 2022, 2023, whatever, maybe I got the years wrong, Titans, where there's no other receiving options. I mean, Calvin Ridley, sliding into a wide receiver two role, that's a great guy to have across from you.
Is he even going to be that? Might be Wandale Robinson being the more of a target hog than Ridley.
True. And then you got Wandale Robinson. You paid $17 million a year to guy who put up 1,000 yards last year as the go-to target in that Giants offense after Malik Nabers went down. So you have Calvin Ridley, who's been the go-to guy target in an offense for the Titans the last 2 years when healthy. You got Wandale Robinson, who became that last year after Malik Nabers got hurt and was probably that with New York before they drafted Malik Nabers. So for his, like, what, his second season, I guess, in the NFL. You got two guys who have done that already, been the go-to guy in an NFL offense, and now you are bringing in Carnell Tate to be the go-to guy in the NFL offense. So even if he doesn't win every rep, you got two other guys presumably on the field that are going to be, you know, if Carnell Tate does end up drawing a double team, okay, good luck covering Calvin Ridley and Wandale Robinson one-on-one. So I think this Titans passing offense is set up for success with the room they have now. And if Carnell Tate can... Here's a stat line I'll throw at you. Tet McMillan last year. Or sorry, he doesn't like Tet. Teteora McMillan last year. 70 catches, 1,014 yards, 7 touchdowns. That was good enough to win Rookie of the Year. Offensive Rookie of the Year.
Yeah.
A.J. Brown had a better rookie season than that from a yardage standpoint and didn't win Offensive
Rookie
of the Year.
Panthers made the playoffs. The Titans, they did, right? Titans made the playoffs.
Yeah, they won the division.
Rookie year? Yeah.
They won the division. Yeah, so I'm curious, if you think if he puts up 1,012 yards and 7 touchdowns, is that a successful rookie season?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. 1,000 receiving yards in Tennessee? In this economy? It's been years. It's been 84 years. Play the Titanic meme. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then I think that the other point here that we're going to see play out, and I was about to get to this, but you have Ray Skull in the comments putting it in here. I almost clipped out a bit of TJ Houshmandzadeh to include in that opening montage, but ultimately decided wasn't worth it. But Houshmandzadeh made this point that with Brian Daboll as the OC, you know, when they drafted Malik Nabers, they immediately made him the focal point of the offense. They said, we're going to get this guy more targets than he really even deserves. We're going to force feed him. And the Giants, obviously, they did have Wandale Robinson, but they didn't have a ton of receiving options on that offense. So they were like, we're just going to pepper Malik Nabers with targets. He's by far our best player on offense. I think they're going to do something similar with Carnell Tate. You know, Carnell Tate didn't have massive target numbers in college because, again, he's playing across from Jeremiah Smith. And also you got Julian Sayin dropping back to pass 20 times in a game, you know, and completing 12 passes. Like, how much production can Carnell Tate even have in that environment? A team that's not throwing the ball a ton and not throwing to him, he's not the focal point. You up that number to 35 to 40 pass attempts per game for Cam Ward potentially. You get that target number up to anywhere from 8 to 15 targets a game for Carnell Tate. You know, that's probably about the range. He'll have games with fewer than that. I doubt he'll have games with more than that. But he's gonna be able to put up 1,000 yards if he stays healthy in this offense, because Brian Daboll is going to make sure of it, because Brian Daboll is going to want to prove to everybody that, yeah, this guy was worth the fourth overall pick. And I know how to use a number one wide receiver. I did it with Stephon Diggs in Buffalo. I did it with Malik Nabers in New York. And now I'm going to do it with Carnell Tate in Tennessee. So what does he have to prove? If he's going to be a number one wide receiver, what does that really mean? What does he have to prove this year? He's got to prove that he can be that focal point and beat coverage, single coverage, press coverage, one-on-one, and move the chains and make catches like he's done his whole life. So I honestly feel better about Carnell Tate today than I did the night the Titans drafted him. Maybe that's a little bit of bias creeping in and the fan optimism angle taking over, but it's also just learning more about a guy that I never really thought was in play for the Titans at pick 4. You know, Justin, we talked for months that it was Jeremiah Love or an edge rusher or maybe Sonny Styles. And we briefly mentioned, is Carnell Tate in the conversation? Maybe. We did a whole episode on him, but we didn't really go super deep on Carnell Tate. The Titans reportedly, by the way, Albert Breer wrote this yesterday, hand-timed him in the 4.4s at the combine when he ran his 40-yard dash, and the electric laser had him at 4.53. The Titans were one of the teams that had him in the 4.4s, so they feel better about his speed. He hit over 21 miles per hour, and even, I think, right just under 22 miles per hour on a few plays in college. So it's not like he doesn't have that speed. Like, 22 miles per hour is about as fast as it gets in the NFL. 23 maybe is, like, the record. But 22, if you're at 22, you're elite speed-wise. And he's a vertical threat. So in addition to doing the third down, get you 9 yards when you need 8, being a big red zone target, he can also make explosive plays down the field because he wins deep. That's the complete package. On top of that, he is an incredible blocker. He blocks ferociously, and as was pointed out on Monday's show, I believe, in the comments, Steve Smith Sr. said this when he was breaking him down. Over 600 blocking snaps last year, not a single holding penalty. He's a dog in the run game. He's a guy that can be on the field on every snap. He can either be that guy at the X. You talked about how you think, you know, he might have the skill set that really makes him, allows him to excel as a Z. He can block. He can catch. I don't know what this guy can't do besides break five tackles on one play and turn a 10-yard curl into a 60-yard touchdown. That's like the one limitation on his game. So I think Carnell Tate can be a number one wide receiver in the NFL.
Zero penalties as a blocker, zero drops, right? Like, just what a tactician in every area of the game. I'm going to drop a hot take, but no, I don't know if it's a hot take or not, but I also don't buy into like some of the they're going to force feed him because he went number four. They don't want, you know, the narratives. I don't worry about that. I don't think Dable's concerned about that. He's got Calvin Ridley, Wandell Robinson. Like, I think he's going to get these guys the ball. I don't think he's just going to force feed, you know, Carnell Tate and forget about everybody else. Bit of a hot take. I hope. Could the Titans really be setting up to be like an explosive pass-first offense? Like, you look at the way they've approached wide receiver this offseason. Big money on Robinson. Obviously, a huge resource on Carnell Tate. And then ignoring running back, essentially, right? Like, I don't think they think Tony Pollard and Tajay Spears are a high-end running back duo. Neither of them are here in 2027. They use, what, a fifth-round pick on a running back? That's been the only, you know, notable addition. And I don't even know that you can call that notable. They might be setting this offense up to just take us where we want to go, Cam Ward. Let's throw the football a lot. We believe in you. We've got five receivers that we believe in. We've got five legitimate NFL-capable receivers. Some of them that are, again, you know, Carnell Tate, Calvin Ridley, we think highly of, Robinson. Sophomores that we think are going to continue developing in DK and Io Manor, they might be setting up to try to throw this football a lot. I'm curious.
Yeah, I think that could be the plan, especially when you think about, like, how do you overcome maybe a subpar interior offensive line and a bad swing tackle situation? Isn't running the ball and forcing those subpar players to create the space? I understand the concerns with having Cam Ward drop back to pass behind that line, but if your passing attack is centered around a quick passing game and you have a guy like Wandale Robinson who can separate quickly, and now you believe you have another one of those guys in Carnell Tate that can separate quickly and get open before the pass rush has a chance to even beat your subpar offensive lineman, maybe it doesn't matter. And you kind of Joe Burrow, Tom Brady, when he had a bad interior line, like, you kind of do that game, the quick game. And you overcome, you mitigate those issues that you might have because you believe in your receivers to win quickly and create plays. And The Truth has a good comment here in the live chat. Nobody brings up how good Tate is on scramble drills. Would really help a mobile QB. Mm-hmm. Not just a mobile QB, but a guy who showed that his improvisational chops that he displayed in college do transfer to the NFL. And he did it a number of times last year, rolling around, buying time, throwing back across his body. Carnell Tate's going to have to get on the same page with Cam Ward on, like, what he likes to see the receivers do during the scramble drill. But this is a great point. Carnell Tate was awesome in the scramble drill at Ohio State and really showed off his, like, sideline footwork, ability to extend over the white line, get those feet down in bounds, drag the back foot 2 feet down, make the catch. You see that come up a lot in the scramble drill because that's when guys are running across the field and then they run all the way to the sideline because the quarterback's bought extra time and they have to make that catch at the sideline. We saw guys like Elik Iemanjir last year fail to make those plays in the, even whether it was scramble drill or just in the offense. Now you bring in a guy who can make that play pretty much every time. Ray Skull also has a question, Justin, that we kind of talked about yesterday a little bit. My issue next year, what wide receiver will be available in the draft that can play in the Z role once we've moved on from Ridley? There's so many prototypical X wide receivers in the 27 draft class. You want to answer who fills in the Z role after the Titans move in from Ridley, Justin?
I mean, why not Shimure DK? I mean, I thought he looked pretty good in that role last year when Ridley went down, and I think he's best suited to play it. I mean, Robinson's obviously going to be the slot here for a couple of years. I don't think DK's an X receiver. He's not very good at beating press. He's not, you know, he doesn't look small, but I don't think he plays all that big. And I don't think he's all that physical. So I think DK is a Z receiver through and through.
Yeah, I agree. I think that he can win out of the slot as well. I don't think DK is an X, though. And I like how DK kind of has this, like, undersized, like, people think of him as a bit undersized. Like, he's over 6 feet.
That's why I said, like, he's not small, but I don't necessarily think he plays big either.
I hear you on that, but it's not like he gets bullied because he's smaller.
No.
And as he continues to adjust to the league, I think that that's an area that he can show improvement in, and he probably needs to show improvement in to maximize his skill set, but I definitely think he can be a guy who is
And Robinson a Z. Played a lot of Z last year for the Giants, right? So I think they've got so many Zs and slots that I'm not worried about those two spots at all.
And I think it'll be interesting to see if, you know, how far DK and Iman are come along in their development this year, because that will determine whether or not the Titans need to add another receiver in the draft in 2027. Because if they feel good about Carnell Tate, Wandale Robinson, Shimmeray, DK, Elik Iamanner, and then you got a special teams guy like Bryce Oliver, or what if Tyron Montgomery becomes, you know, good enough to be a wide receiver 4 or 5 in the league? Like, then you have a pretty good core, and you can move on from Calvin Ridley without hardly skipping a beat, and you don't have to invest another draft pick in that position, and you can fix the left tackle position long term and get another defensive back in here and get another interior lineman if you need one, and an edge rusher, you know? So that's probably what the plan would be if these young receivers can establish and prove themselves. So I think we answered the question. Can Carnell Tate be a number one wide receiver? Yes, Carnell Tate is a number one wide receiver, and he will be the Titans' number one wide receiver, and I think he's a great bet to win Offensive Rookie of the Year. I think Jeremiah Love is too, but is Jeremiah Love going to get the touches in Arizona with Algier and James Conner to actually win that award, or is he going to be a guy who sort of like breaks out in week 11 and it's like, oh, the last 5 games, Jeremiah Love was really good, but he's not good enough to win Rookie of the Year just because he was good for 5 games. You know, that kind of situation. And then Fernando Mendoza is the other big competitor, I would say. Well, Mendoza might not start. He might not start the whole year. We'll see what the Raiders, how long the Raiders can like keep him on the bench. I guess the other competition, there's a lot of receiver competition, right? So Jordan Tyson in New Orleans, but he's playing second fiddle to Chris Olave. Mekhi Lemon in Philadelphia, but they view Devonta Smith as the JSN level player if AJ Brown's gone. Casey Concepcion doesn't have a quarterback in Cleveland, and neither does Denzel Boston, and they're going to be competing with each other for snaps and touches. So I don't know. I think Carnell Tate has a real legitimate chance to be the Offensive Rookie of the Year. If he puts up 1,000 yards and 8 touchdowns, like, he probably wins the award just because there's not another, unless Ty Simpson takes over because Matthew Stafford's back explodes and Ty Simpson actually gets to play. Or, you know, I'm not expecting Cade Klubnik or Garrett Nussmeier to get enough snaps to be Offensive Rookie of the Year. I think Tate has a real shot to win that award.
I go Love just because I think he's going to get a bajillion. I do think he's going to get a bajillion touches. He'll be the Kevin Love Minnesota Timberwolves, empty calories on a bad football team kind of thing is what I'm expecting for Love, but we'll see. Yeah. I think that's going to do it almost for today's episode. We do have a super chat tip that we got to hit that we missed. We're talking, so we didn't interrupt, but you want to hit that thing real quick?
Oh my goodness gracious.
Kegs 6, he's got no comment, but he's up for $1.99 super chat tip. Thank you so much. I knew I gave you some crap the other day, Kegs. This was a guy who said he's always negative in here. He's not always negative. I apologize. We appreciate that you're in here. You dropped a couple of great comments earlier. I'm surprised you didn't attach a question to this one, but that's totally fine. Thanks for the generous super chat tip. Let's hug it out. I'm sorry for going at you the other day, and thanks for being in here today.
And that'll do it. If there's no further questions from the chat, I think we can get out of here. Justin, I can't believe we did a whole segment on
Carnell Tate.
And I didn't play that drop one single time until the very end of it. But all right, that's it for today's show. We'll be back tomorrow. We don't have a topic yet. Friday, we're going to do something fun and interesting. Friday, Robert Saleh is speaking to the media, supposedly, at 10:45 a.m. Central Time. We'll see if that starts on time. Ahead of the start of Titans rookie minicamp. We will be live at 10:30. We're going to be live, and what we're going to do, Justin, is I want to try this out and see if it's fun, see if you guys like it, see if we like it. react live to Robert Saleh's press conference. So what I'm going to do is put us in this sort of this little 2x1 look here where you see the Ohio State receivers graphic. That'll be the Robert Saleh press conference. And we'll just play it live. And if there's anything that we want to react to, we'll have it right there to react to. So we'll watch it together. You guys can throw comments in the chat on comments you find interesting that we might want to circle back to. And we'll kind of go into that episode with a loose plan, but no real topic plan. And the plan is whatever Robert Saleh says at the presser, we're going to talk about afterwards. So we'll talk for about 15 minutes, maybe 20 before the presser starts. It'll play, and then we'll react to it. I think it's going to be a really fun way to do an episode with a press conference live like that. So we'll figure out tomorrow's show. In the meantime, thanks everyone for tuning in. Make sure you like this stream. Stay after a few seconds and comment on the video. Subscribe to the channel. We're cruising towards 7,000 subs. Love to get there by, like, I don't know, mid-summer or so. Yeah, we would love you guys to smash that subscribe button, send the show to a friend, and we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, y'all stay safe out there and tighten up.
A Broadway Sports Media production.